Tonight's reading is from Luke chapter 18, verses 9 to 14, and it can be found on page 1052 if you're using the church Bibles. To some who were confident of their own righteousness and looked down on everyone else, Jesus told this parable. Two men went up to the temple to pray, one a Pharisee and the other a tax collector. The Pharisee stood by himself and prayed, "God, I thank you that I am not like other people, robbers, evildoers, adulterers, or even like this tax collector. I fast twice a week and give a tenth of all I get." But the tax collector stood at a distance. He would not even look up to heaven, but beat his breast and said, "God, have mercy on me, a sinner. I tell you that this man, rather than the other, went home justified before God. For all those who exalt themselves will be humbled, and those who humble themselves will be exalted."
Thank you so much. Thank you for the reading. Thank you for your prayers. Thank you for your welcome. It is really amazing to be back after 10 years of being away. It's so nice to see a few familiar faces, and so amazingly wonderful to see so many new faces as well since then. It's a lovely blessing for you as a church. I wonder when the last time you had to impress someone at a job interview. Now, I looked on the internet for some advice, came up with these pictures. This is the first one. Remember, every question is a test. So when they say, "How are you?" reply, "Goal orientated." How about this piece of advice? Be confident. After answering each question, kiss your fist and then say, "Nailed it," to yourself. Plan to do that at the end of this talk. And then the final one, make a point of mentioning you failed religious studies and say, "The only thing I worship is productivity." I think if we all follow that sort of advice, we'll go far, won't we? We'll impress whoever is interviewing us. But it's a silly example, perhaps, but we're always trying to impress people, aren't we? A few years ago, I think it was last year, a Dutch student called Zille van den Born, she put on Facebook these amazing stories, this amazing picture of where she'd been on holiday. She'd spent these 42 days, she said, in the Far East, somewhere in Southeast Asia. It was all faked. She didn't leave her bedroom, pretty much. She photoshopped that picture on the beach, this picture with one of the local people, all to make a point. This is all part of her university final year project, to make a point about how desperate people are to impress each other and how easy it is to fake it. I suspect if you're a Christian here this evening, you'll know something of that feeling, that need, that desire to impress maybe each other, but definitely the need to impress God. To point to yourself, to point to things you've done, feelings you have, to say, "God, I'm worthy of you." I was talking to someone just this week, and they said, I just don't feel like I give enough money. I don't feel like I serve or work hard enough. I don't feel like I do enough. How could God love me? I'm so unimpressive in his eyes. Might be true for someone who would call themselves a Christian, but I think if you're here this evening and you wouldn't call yourself a Christian, I suspect that same sort of feeling is familiar to you too. You may not be living to impress God, but there'll be someone somewhere that you are living to impress, even if it's actually just yourself. I had a friend, not a Christian, and he, lovely guy, and he was determined to live right in this world, so he could walk around with his head held high, proud, confident that he was living life rightly. He went to such great extents that he became a vegetarian. That was part of it for him. And then from there, he went and became a vegan. He had fake leather belts. He had fake bacon. I don't even know what that is. It was a crime. But that's the extent he went to, to reassure himself that he was living rightly, that he was living well. And what we're hopefully going to see tonight, as we go through this passage in Luke together, is that Jesus says, if you're a Christian, you can be liberated from that constant need to impress God. You can be freed from that. And in fact, I think Jesus goes further than that. And he says to us all, whether you're a Christian or not, having that sort of mentality, looking to ourselves for some store of merit, of work, or feeling, or action, is not only exhausting, but it's actually deadly. It's actually deadly. Now, just as I understand it, you guys have been going through Luke, a story at a time. And you know by now a little bit about where we are in Luke. Luke's an account of Jesus' life. And he starts off earlier in the book. You get a lot of stories about Jesus, the miracles he does, the amazing things he does. But now we're at a different point in Luke. Jesus is probably one of the most famous men in first century Palestine at this stage. If he was living today, he'd be the subject of all that sort of Facebook clickbait you get, or BuzzFeed would be running articles on him. 21 things you never knew Jesus said, or 5 things you need to know about Jesus today. He'd be the center of attention. But his emphasis has shifted now. He's not doing so many miracles, so many amazing things. He's teaching, he's telling stories. And he's on his way to Jerusalem, that center point of the Christian message, where he's going to be crucified and he's going to be resurrected from the grave. That's where he is now. And this story, I don't know if you caught it, in verse 9, he's talking to a very specific group of people, or at least it appears that it's a very specific group of people. It is to some who were confident of their own righteousness and looked down on everyone else. Righteousness, one of those words, isn't it? Not a lot of people use that word today to mean, I think, what Jesus meant it to mean. When I hear the word righteousness, I always think of a pure, white, freshly laundered tablecloth. It's pure. It's spotless. Righteousness is that, but of a person. Someone who has done nothing wrong, nothing to stain their reputation. And they've done everything right. That's what that sense of righteousness means. And this is to people, and actually it literally reads, to those who trusted to themselves for their own righteousness. That's how it reads literally. These are people who trust to themselves in terms of having that reputation, that ability. And it, as you see, it leads to looking down on other people. So this is the target audience for this story in Luke. This is the target audience. And it starts with two men going up to pray in verse 10. First is a Pharisee. Now, you've got to understand, the Pharisee is your model citizen. It's not just someone who obeys all the religious rules. It's someone who literally helped write the book of rules. I think it's easy, if you've been a Christian a while, and some of you no doubt here have been, it's easy to shortcut into thinking that the Pharisee is going to be the bad guy because you know the end of the story. If you were one of Luke's original listeners, the Pharisee is the good guy. He's the honourable guy, the person you admire. If he came through that door now, we'd almost say, oh, come to the front, have this seat. Oh, we're so glad you're here. We're so glad you're here, Mr. Pharisee. It's an honour for us for you to be with us tonight. That's how Luke's original hearers would have felt about the Pharisee. We'd admire him. But there's two. There's Pharisee and there's the tax collector. Tax collector, by contrast, scum of the earth. Absolute scum of the earth. He's the sort of person who, if they came through that door, we'd be a bit embarrassed. How can he show his face here? See, a tax collector, he was someone who was collaborating with the invading Romans. And it's not just like we all aren't fond of the tax man, the inland revenue. He was collaborating with the enemy, and the tax collectors would usually add their own little fee on top. So not only was he cooperating with his people's enemy, he was fleecing his own people to add insult to injury. Not a popular guy. He's clearly going to be the villain of Jesus' story. I think, I was trying to think of contemporary illustrations, people that we would feel similar about than Luke's audience does. And I was thinking, if the guy, Vester Flanagan, the guy who shot that news reporter and her cameraman, if he walked in, that's how we'd feel. That's the sort of disgust we'd feel, the outrage. Or Jonathan Thompson Glover, who was this week convicted of making all those indecent images of children at the Bristol School. That's how Luke's audience would feel about the tax collector. A sense of outrage. This guy is no good. He's the opposite of righteous. And yet these two men go up to pray. And you can see early on, that the Pharisee, I think you could say that he is self-impressed. That's what you get that sort of picture. He's self-impressed. And you see that by the way he stands. I don't know if you notice that. He stands by himself in verse 10. You see, he stands by himself, and again, literally, the language reads, he stood by himself and prayed to himself. The original language is kind of reflexive. Here's a man, he's standing by himself, probably in the place reserved for really special people, and he's praying. Who's he praying to? He's kind of praying to himself. He prays to himself, and what does he say? It's interesting, he uses the word I five times in the original. God, I thank you that I am not like other people. I fast twice a week. I give a tenth of all I get. Wow. Well, the impression you get of this person actually is that they're pretty self-centered, actually. A theologian called Calvin would have called it that he's curved in on himself. He's all about himself and what he's not done. And done. That's what you see in his prayer, don't you? First, a list of things he hasn't done. I'm not a robber, an evildoer, or an adulterer. Tick, tick, tick. Haven't done any of those things. And not only have I not done those things, I'm not like the people who do those things either. I'm not like this tax collector. Back of this. He's noticed him. He's clocked him. He's got that sense of outrage that this tax collector could even darken the door of God's temple. Haven't done this. Tick, tick, tick. And I'm not like that person over there. I just think it's at this point that the story Jesus is telling us might start to make us feel a little bit uncomfortable. If you're a Christian here with me tonight, I suspect you know that sort of thinking. Dear God, I'm not like those people out there, those irreligious people, those militant atheists, those people who say they hate you. I'm not like those people. I'm good. I'm all right. But you don't need to be a Christian to think like that either. How often have you heard people say, well, I'm not perfect, but I'm not a murderer. I don't fiddle my taxes. I'm not perfect, but. I have a friend who works with in Bedford Prison. And he says, when you go in and you talk to the murderers, they say, well, I may have murdered someone, but I'm not a rapist. They're the bad ones. And you go and talk to the rapist and they say, I may have raped someone, but I'm not a paedophile. It's amazing, isn't it, how good we are at justifying ourselves wherever we are on that sort of social ladder. I haven't done dot, dot, dot. But it doesn't stop there. He goes on. I haven't done this, but I do these things. He fasts and he gives. And both of those things, he does more than the regulation amount. So there's like a minimum amount that you're meant to do as a good, faithful Jew, and he does more. What he's saying is, God, you should be well impressed with me. I go over and above, beyond what is required. And again, you start to think, oh, that line of thinking feels eerily familiar if you're a Christian, doesn't it? Oh, dear God, I read my Bible in the morning and in the evening. How good am I? I go to church both in the morning and in the evening. I serve on this team, this team, and this team. Start to look to ourselves, see what we've done. And it's true if you're here tonight and you're not a Christian too. We look to the things we have done. I love my family. I work hard. I haven't got much, but what I do have, I share with my friends and family. We're always looking for ways with which we might be self-impressed. That's the Pharisee. But as you've seen, the tax collector is quite different. Quite different to the Pharisee. The tax collector, he stands at a distance. He can't go to that place where the really holy people are. He stands at a distance. And the sense you get rolling off him is that sense of self-hatred, of shame, of guilt. He's too ashamed even to raise his eyes towards the sky, the heavens, where God symbolically might be. And there he's striking his breast in that gesture of shame and guilt. That's how he's approaching this prayer, and his prayer is totally different to the Pharisees. The tax collector's prayer is totally different. Have mercy on me. And that prayer, it's a prayer that is linked to the time and place where it's being prayed. So when people went up to pray in first century Palestine at the temple, it's usually the time when they'd offer a sacrifice. A lamb would be slain in the temple. And what that was is, as lots of you will know, is the lamb was symbolically taking the punishment from God that the people deserved so that they didn't have to face it themselves. And here is the tax collector, and he's standing there at the temple during the time of sacrifice, and effectively saying, God, I want that for myself. Have mercy on me. Actually, what he literally says is, please propitiate me, or propitiate for me. That's what the original says. And again, it's like righteousness, isn't it? You don't find yourself standing next to people often who use that sort of word. I wonder if you can imagine it. If you're standing by at the bus stop, and it's not a fancy bus stop, it's just a pole on the ground, and it's bucketing it down, and you're getting soaked. It's the fine rain that soaks you through. And you're getting drenched to the skin. You might say, I really wish this rain would be propitiated away from me. You might. It's unlikely. But that's what it would mean. It means to divert away from you. So what you're effectively asking... Yikes. Don't lean over. It's for something like this. You're asking for something to divert the rain away from you to somewhere else. That's what propitiation means. Prayer that this tax collector has. Please divert the punishment that I know I deserve. Please divert it away from me to someone else, to somewhere else. He knows he's got nothing to offer. He's not saying, look, I can offer you this. Because of this. No, it's pure a cry for rescue. And if you're here tonight and you wouldn't call yourself a Christian, perhaps Jesus' criticism of the religious person, the Pharisee, doesn't surprise you very much. You've long known all the problems, the weaknesses with religious hypocrisy. Jesus' criticism of the Pharisee comes as no surprise to you at all. And so maybe you've embraced atheism, or irreligion, non-religion. But it's just possible, I suggest to you, that you don't see the weakness in irreligion either, of atheism, of a world which is constructed of which is constructed by people themselves, where people construct their own identities, their own morals, their own values. And they show who created us, who made us, who gives us significance, purpose, value and identity, who made us in his image to live his way. But that just might be a risk for you. You see the weakness in religion, but you don't see the weakness in irreligion. There's a quote coming up from Aldous Huxley. This is what he said. I had motive for not wanting the world to have a meaning, consequently assumed that it had none, and was able without any difficulty to find satisfying reasons for this assumption. For myself, the philosophy of meaningless was essentially an instrument of liberation, sexual and political. See what he's saying? He didn't want there to be a God, so he chose not to believe there was a God. But there is a third way between religion, the religious hypocrisy of the Pharisee, and irreligion. And you can see it in the tax collector, who in verse 14, we're told that God rescues all who cry to him. That's what we see in verse 14. There's a verdict. What we have in this passage in Luke is two unimpressive people. We have the Pharisee and the tax collector. Neither impress God. Neither impress God. But look what Jesus says. He starts his sentence, I tell you. Now when Jesus uses those words, I tell you, it's like, look, I know it's Sunday evening and it's warm and it's August bank holiday, but if you've been asleep to this moment, this is what you need to listen to. This is it. That's what those words mean. Wake up. This is the main point. I tell you that the tax collector is the one that went home justified, included, justified. It means that they're declared to be like that white tablecloth, pure, spotless, as if they've done nothing wrong and as if they've done everything right. And it's the tax collector who gets that verdict. And I love the language. It's passive. He goes home justified. It's something that is done to him, not by him. And it's past tense. It's been done once and for all. If you get to my age, early 30s, definitely early 30s, you'll have probably spent total many days in IKEA. That shrine, that temple to furniture and textiles, that place of soulless desperation and sadness. At one point, the IKEA family card, I think we've got a slide there, that their slogan, it was a great slogan actually, their loyalty card, the slogan was, "Members only, everyone's invited." Members only, everyone's invited. And what you see here is that not everyone in this story goes home justified. Only one does. But everyone's invited. Anyone can, like the tax collector, cry to God for help and receive that verdict of justification. And the reason is that in the end of verse 14, whoever exalts self will be humbled, whoever humbles himself will be exalted. You see, the Pharisee, he thinks in all his cleverness and all his moral works that he's impressing God. But really, he's ignoring God. And he's been ignoring God for a long, long time. It's not that stuff he's doing is wrong. It's good to give. It's good that he's not a robber and an adulterer. That's fine. But he's ignored his maker, his creator. I think we understand that, don't we, instinctively? Just imagine a single mum. She's working three jobs. In the morning, she's a care assistant working shifts at a care home. At lunchtime, she's a dinner lady at the local school. And in the evening, she does cleaning at a local office, working her fingers to the bone, all so that she can send her son to university. Working like a maniac trying to get her son to university. And the time comes, he gets his A-levels, he gets into Oxford or Cambridge or wherever, and she says to her son as she sends him off, "I just want you to remember three things. Work hard, be honest and be kind. Just three things." And so he goes away to university, spends 3 years away from home studying hard, and at the end he gets his top first, and at the end he can say, "Look, I've worked really hard. Look at my grades. You can see I've worked really hard. And I've been kind. I've been volunteering at these different university clubs that go and serve in local schools and stuff. And I've always been honest. If I've made mistakes, I've owned up." Yeah, he's a pretty good guy, isn't he? But then you find not once in those 3 years did he call his mum. Never lifted the phone. Never wrote to her. I think instinctively we see how that's wrong. To ignore the one who gave him so much. And it's the same with the Pharisee. He's ignoring God, the one who doesn't just give him a place at university and all that resource, but gives him life itself. The Pharisee is like a man who goes to the doctor and is listening to the verdict. And he's not really listening. And he says to the doctor, I'm fine. My resting heart rate is, 50 beats per minute. That's pretty good, isn't it? That's pretty healthy. I've got doctors nodding at me. Amazing resting heart rate. Feeling healthy. Blood pressure, fine. I'm fine. And the doctor says, no, you're not listening. The tests are back. It's cancer. You're rotting from the inside. That's what the Pharisee is like. Ignoring his maker. Concentrated entirely on himself and his own perception of himself. But a cry for help, like the tax collector, is always heard. Just recently, I think it was back end of July, a British tourist, 63-year-old, he was in the Australian outback, and he saw on the map that just nearby was a really picturesque creek, bit of a waterfall and stuff. So he set out. He was wearing swimming trunks, swimming shorts, T-shirt and a hat. That's all he had with him. And he set out into the outback to find this place. And rather predictably, he got lost. That's not a good thing in the Australian outback. It's a big place. And when he didn't return at night, people started sending out search parties, helicopters. And this guy didn't know what to do. So in the end, he just wrote on the sand by the river, this message says help, and the date 2807, 28th of July, and an arrow to where he was sheltered. And mercifully, one of the helicopters sent out to find him saw his message on the sand, his cry for help, and it was just before they diverted to look in another area, and came and found him and rescued him. Amazing, just a simple cry for help, plucked off and out of the outback. Wasn't cheap though. It cost 800,000 Australian dollars to mount this huge search and rescue operation. And the rescue that God offers us doesn't come cheap either. God's rescue is costly. In our story we read, didn't we, that the tax collector stands there beating his breast in shame and guilt. Well, when Jesus goes to the cross, he doesn't beat his breast, his side is pierced. As he acts as that sacrificial lamb on the cross, taking the punishment that we all deserve for the way we've ignored our Creator. Philippians describes it like this, just have the slide up. And Jesus, being found in appearance as a man, he humbled himself by becoming obedient to death, even death on a cross. And therefore God exalted him to the highest place and gave him the name that is above every name. See, what happens on the cross is what we talked about earlier with the umbrella. God propitiates. He diverts the wrath that you and I deserve for all the ways in which we've messed up, and he directs it to his only son, Jesus. And on that cross, Jesus is treated like the tax collector in all his wretchedness. He's treated like the Pharisee in all his self-important self-righteousness. He's treated like Vesper Flanagan and any other gun-wielding maniac who's caused a massacre in the last few years. He's treated like Thompson Glover and any other paedophile. He's treated like any other gossip or liar or fraudster, any other rapist, any other tax fiddler. He is treated as the God-ignoring rebel so that we could be treated as those spotless, perfect, loyal children of God. Which means that if you're a Christian here tonight, you don't need to be anxious like that. You don't need to be anxious and worry that you haven't got the right set of works or gifts to offer to God, to prove that you're worthy, to impress him. He knows you're not, but he loves you. You look at Jesus and you see that God loves you. I think it's easy, isn't it, to think that I don't have sufficient faith. My faith isn't deep enough or right enough. I don't pray right enough or frequently enough to be in God's good books. The tax collector says that if you cry to God for help, he will rescue you. God accepts us before we're good, not when we're good enough. But there's also a challenge too, isn't there? There's a challenge. Whenever we read a passage like this, a parable, a story that Jesus tells, we can use it like a mirror to look at our own reflection, do a bit of self-examination. Are there ways in which we are tempted to be self-righteous, like the Pharisee? And it is deadly. If you start thinking like the Pharisee, you will never ever tell anyone about Jesus, the good news about Jesus. Because you'll stop thinking that they'll get it or that they or deserve it. You'll stop serving in a local church because you actually start to think that people should be serving you. You're the one who's right. They should be serving you. If you start to think of yourself as self-righteous, you'll stop obeying God. Doing what the Pharisee does and having a checklist of things you do and don't do is a perfect way to insulate yourself from the correcting word that comes from the Bible. And eventually, if we think like the Pharisee, we'll grow cold to God because we'll think we realise that we don't need him at all. C.S. Lewis said this, "A proud man is always looking down on things and people. And of course, as long as you're looking down, you cannot see something that is above you." Andrew Murray said something similar. "Pride must die in you, or nothing of heaven can live in you." It's the peril of the self-righteous attitude that you see in the Pharisee. And I say this to myself as much as I say it to all of you here. We're all tempted to think like this. And you know why I know this? Because when I read this first, what was the first thought, my first reaction that came to me? Thank God, I am not like the Pharisee. It's deep, isn't it? There's something in the heart of all of us that wants to be good. But the amazing news, the news of the gospel, the news of Jesus' sacrifice, is that even those of us who think like that can be forgiven by God when we cry to him for help. Again, maybe you're here tonight and you're not a Christian. Maybe you are actually here, a bit like a tax collector. You long for that sense of peace, of forgiveness. Well, like the tax collector, you could go home justified. You just need to cry to God for help. Have confidence in Christ alone, not in anything you've done. Please, don't be like that patient, not listening to the doctor. Concentrating on what you can do, the identity and the morals and the measuring stick of goodness that you've created yourself. This passage, Jesus is saying, I tell you, listen to your maker. There's a third way between religious hypocrisy and irreligion, and it is to have confidence in Christ alone. Last year in April, and we'll close with this, I don't know if you remember, there was a ferry disaster in South Korea, and over 100 people lost their lives. And one of the most moving things about that whole event is some of the text messages that came from people on the ferry to ones that they dearly loved. So this is one student to a brother. The ship ran into something and it's not moving. They say the Coast Guard just arrived. Brother, don't panic. Just do what you're told to do and then you'll be fine. Sadly, he wasn't. He wasn't among the survivors. Here's another one. Student Shin Yong-jin texted his mother. This might be the last chance to say I love you, was the text. I love you too, son, the mother texted back, unaware of what was going on. They're precious words, aren't they? I tell you. They're the words of those who are about to die or think they're about to die to ones they dearly, dearly love. And what you have in this passage, the message of who gets to go home justified, these are the words of someone who is about to die. He's about to go to the cross. And they're words to those that he dearly, dearly loves, to you and me. Because Luke wants us to know that Jesus wants us all to cry to him for help, to have confidence in him, so that we might go home, not just home to Selly Oak or Harborne or wherever, justified. He wants us to go to our eternal home, justified forever by his son, Jesus.